afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. In our afternoon docket, we have three cases set for oral submission and three that we will be conferring on without oral argument. Your panel this afternoon consists of, to my left, Justice Dabney Basil, and to my right, Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So we will proceed with our first case if the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call Lyndon Lee Adams versus the state of Texas. May it please the court. Mr. Richard A. Henderson will argue for the appellant. Mr. David Richards will argue for the state.
Mr. Henderson.
At the outset, I want to say thank you for granting oral argument. I'm hitting 41 years of practice, and with e-filing, we don't even see the clerks anymore. And we hardly ever have any direct interaction with the appellate court much anymore, except for these brief oral arguments. And I remember the late Dixon Holman at a seminar. We were talking about what we should do in oral argument, et cetera. And I said, has oral argument ever really changed your mind, Your Honor? He says, he looked at me kind of puzzled for a minute. He says, no, I don't think it ever did. But I still think it's important that we have these moments where we see each other eye to eye and talk about the case. And I hope that we never get away from that. That said, I represent Lyndon Lee Adams. It's a relatively complex set of facts. One thing they say is don't go through a set of facts in oral argument, but I think it's necessary to kind of give us a basis. On May 7th, 2015, 1:30 a.m., Jonathan Wavenaugh was delivering fuel for Growing Dot Company at a QT gas station on Bryan Irving Road in Fort Worth, Texas. The video shows Lewevino enter the store about 1:28 a.m. And my client enters the store and tries to buy beer and is refused. There doesn't seem to be any confrontation, but Adams leaves the store. A white Ford Mustang drives in front of the store, and then there's the sound of what seems to be a gunshot. Nobody really pays much attention at the time, but the Growing Dot personnel check a few hours later because Mr. Lewevino was supposed to have already been back at the terminal. And the clerk was contacted. He goes out, sees Lewevino unresponsive, calls 911, and he is pronounced dead at the scene. Then an unusual set of facts happens at 3:30 a.m. Adams, my client, is seen by Benbrook Police Department in a strip center at 999 Winscott Road. Benbrook Police Department Officer Cooper sees Adams park, rolling a wheel on a curb island, and he pulls in and out of a couple of parking spaces, and Cooper decides to contact my client. And that's the basis of our search question, that we believe at that point he did not have probable cause. But Cooper sees what he believes is an open container of beer, warm to the touch, nearly empty. He does a field sobriety test, but Adams is not impaired. And the officers observe a, quote, bulge, end quote, in Mr. Adams' pants, and he tells them it's a gun. So then he is handcuffed and the vehicle is searched. They find a small amount of marijuana and another gun, and they bring in a drug dog. And the drug dog doesn't alert on anything in the car, and they let him go. They let Mr. Adams go. They give him a ticket for paraphernalia, and but they forgot to give him his driver's license back. About 3 to 4 hours later, Adams is stopped for speeding at 113 miles an hour in Palo Pinto by DPS Trooper Blue in Palo Pinto, Texas. And Blue smells some marijuana. He searches the car. He sees the guns in the back of the car, but doesn't do anything about it. Lets him go. Detective Cedillo is the lead detective for Fort Worth, and he was there and did the crime scene in the early a.m. at the QT. And then he coincidentally returns to the QT to get some air in his tires and just happens to get behind a Ford Mustang, which at this point he had been given information from Benbrook Police Department with the license plate number of Adams' car from the stop that occurred at 3:30 in the morning. So Cedillo gets behind him, has him pulled over. They take him down voluntarily, they say, to the Fort Worth Police Department. They get a search warrant. They find a Glock 9mm and the Glock 9mm in the trunk, and the projectile and the ballistics match up to the projectiles that were recovered from the body and the truck back at the QT. To say it's a rather complex and unusual set of facts. But I think the facts, our argument is fairly simple. We think there's legal insufficiency to show that my client was the one that pulled the trigger and killed Mr. Loivano. There's nothing, they did some DNA swabs, but they didn't ever perform any DNA. There is a gun in the trunk whose ballistics match up to the bullets. No doubt about it, that's the gun that killed him. But there's nothing to show that Mr. Adams pulled the trigger and shot Mr. Loivano. We think that the old Wong Sun case that we heard of way back in law school, the fruit of the poisonous tree, we think the Benbrook Police Department had no probable cause to detain him in the parking lot, and everything that flowed therefrom, getting his driver's license, eventually the license plate that matches up to Detective Cedillo's report that he's given that information from Benbrook, but none of that would have ever happened if Benbrook had not detained Mr. Adam.
So it's your contention that driving erratically, running over a curb at 3 o'clock in the morning in a private parking lot is not probable cause to pull somebody over?
Well, I don't know if it was different. It was necessarily radical driving. There was nothing to indicate that there was anything illegal that he had done with the way he parked his car.
But counsel, he doesn't have to. It's a question of whether or not his conduct constituted a reasonable suspicion that there had been an offense at that point in time, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly the state's argument. Our argument is that he's doing nothing illegal, nothing that warranted the detention. And even at that, they let him go. They didn't arrest him for anything.
But they issued him a couple of citations.
They gave him a citation for drug paraphernalia and told him to put the guns in his trunk. They didn't even charge him with unlawfully carrying a weapon. But that's the thrust of our argument. If the court determines that there was probable cause for him to do a Terry stop, and then we lose. You know, but our contention is it was without probable cause, and everything that the fruit that came from that poisonous original tree, what should have been suppressed. And also, there's absolutely nothing to show that he pulled the trigger, that there wasn't another passenger in the car, and that he's actually the person that shot.
Well, but
I mean, it's circumstantial. There's a lot of circumstances.
And there's a lot of, I mean, let's talk about this circumstantial evidence for a while. I mean, I'm going to run through a set of facts with you.
Sure.
And you tell me if I'm getting these facts wrong, okay?
We
know when the driver arrived at the Quick Stop.
Right.
We know the defendant was there at the same time.
Right.
About after the defendant, apparently shortly after the defendant left the store, the attendant heard what he believed were shots.
I'm not sure the attendant heard that. They picked that up on the audio of the video.
Okay. Well, and I'll accept that, but we'll change that fact to say that shortly after the defendant left, what someone perceived to be shots were heard.
That's correct.
Okay. The video taken at the Quick Stop shows a vehicle of a particular make, model, and color leaving the lot shortly after the sound of the shots were heard.
Correct. It's a white Mustang.
Okay.
There's no doubt that now, my client drives a white Mustang. He stopped in Benbrook and in Palo Pinto.
Okay.
And later Cedillo finds him.
Right. And apparently the vehicle was leaving, I believe there's a suggestion in the record that the vehicle was leaving at a high rate of speed.
Vehicle's driving at 113 miles per hour in Palo Pinto.
Sure.
But I don't
But at the time it was leaving the lot, was it leaving at a high rate of speed?
I don't remember that. It may have, okay. It may have been. I don't remember
All right.
that detail.
And then 2 hours or less after the sounds of the shots and the video of the vehicle leaving the lot, a vehicle of the same description is seen by Officer Cooper. And during the stop of the vehicle, a person ID'd as a defendant is driving that car, and the defendant is carrying on his person the firearm that was later identified as being the firearm that, that killed the victim in this case.
I'm not sure that we can say that he had the firearm, that that was the one that was in his pants, because he had another gun, and the guns were found in the trunk.
Well, as I understand from Officer Cooper, well, there were two officers at the scene, right? One of them said he had a bulge in his pants.
Right.
And the defendant responds, that's my 9mm. And the officer took the firearm from him and not only took the firearm from him, but also took down the serial number of that weapon. And the serial number of that weapon matched the weapon that was found subsequently as the one having fired the fatal shot.
That's correct.
And it's your contention on the basis of that string of facts, it was not a reasonable inference to identify your client as the shooter in this case.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the only argument I have.
Okay.
And you can add to those facts that he was the only one in the vehicle and there was gunshot residue found in the vehicle.
Well, we don't know that he was the only one.
He was the only one who went in the store. He was the only one in the vehicle the first time he was stopped. He was the only one in the vehicle the second and third times he was stopped.
Correct. There's nothing to indicate that there wasn't anybody else in the vehicle at the QT station. Our contention is that somebody else could have pulled that trigger and could have shot Mr. Levinow. Do you have further questions?
Further?
No.
Thank you. Richards?
May it please the court, Mr. Henderson, good morning. I'll address both issues. I don't think this is a close case. It was a cleanly tried trial. As Mr. Henderson pointed out, there is, in, I think in his brief, he calls it an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence. But what he is suggesting is that there is no direct evidence in the case showing that Mr. Adams, as opposed to some other person, pulled the trigger. That has never been required in a circumstantial evidence case. And I think you need look no further than the recent case in the Court of Criminal Appeals, Ingerson versus State, which I cited for almost all of the circumstances and factors this court should use in judging whether or not the evidence, the circumstantial evidence, was legally sufficient. And if you look at reading between the lines in the Ingerson case, there is no requirement that in that case, in the Court of Criminal Appeals, that the state need prove that Mr. Ingerson was driving the car alone and that there wasn't another person in the car. Likewise, there is no requirement in this case from any legal authority of any kind that the state need to prove that Mr. Adams was in that car as opposed to someone else in the car perhaps getting Mr. Adams' gun and firing their shots, because clearly it is the same gun. Officer Richard Cooper, when he stopped Mr. Adams in that parking lot, the Benbrook Strip Center parking lot, actually, when he determined that Mr. Adams was carrying a gun from the bulge, he, and Mr. Adams admitted, I've got this gun in my pocket, he secured it after the stop in the trunk of the car. He didn't arrest Mr. Adams for that. He secured it in the trunk. During the search of the car, they also found a Colt pistol, but the Colt pistol wasn't used. It was the Glock, the 9mm Glock, that was tied to this offense forensically. And Mr. Henderson, on the Fourth Amendment issue, says that there was no probable cause for the stop. But under Terry v. Ohio, which he cited during argument, there doesn't need to be probable cause. There only needs to be reasonable suspicion. So the question is, was Officer Richard Cooper in possession of the requisite legal reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Adams in that parking lot? Now, at the time of the stop, it was 3:30 in the morning. The only other cars in that parking lot were from two people who were described as, I believe, Koreans, opening up their donut shop. They had just arrived. The shop was not open. Other than that, other than them arriving, all of the other businesses were closed, and the parking lot was empty. But Mr. Adams pulled in as they were pulling in, and Mr. Adams didn't just park in the lot. He parked in a lot in a parking place, and then he immediately pulled out of that parking lot place, went to another parking place, inexplicably parked there, then again immediately backed up and went to another parking place, a third parking place. In the attempt to get into the third parking place, he ran over a median, a curb on an island in the parking lot. And this stop that Officer Cooper undertook was not even with his car. He just walked up to him. He said appellant was already parked. He walked up to him and was concerned when he saw an open container in the car and this curious, odd behavior of driving, parking, running up over a curb. And he conducted, not he, but there were other officers by that time that were there that conducted sobriety tests, and he didn't arrest him. So the question does not involve probable cause. Probable cause plays no, is not an issue in the case. The question is whether or not Officer Cooper had the reasonable suspicion to do a Terry stop, an investigatory stop. And that is the only issue. Now, there were two other stops that evening. And initially, if you look at the motion to suppress, the written motion to suppress filed by trial counsel, they were challenging the other stops as well. But Joetta Keene, who is one of the two defense attorneys, before the hearing on the motion to suppress, advised Judge Gallagher, look, we are narrowing the issue here. We're not going to contest that Officer Blue, or State Trooper Blue, when he stopped appellant going 113 miles an hour on a freeway in Palo Pinto, didn't have reasonable suspicion for the stop. That was not an issue any longer in the case. Likewise, the third stop, which is the stop when appellant was found to have made an illegal lane change, that's not contested, or wasn't contested in the trial court. So it is clear from the record on the motion to suppress that the state's decision to put on Officer Cooper and only Officer Cooper about the Benbrook stop was directly related to Joetta Keene, defense attorney, advising the trial court, we're narrowing the scope of our challenge here to only the challenge in the strip center parking lot. And matter of fact, Michelle Hartman made the point of saying, because of the representation that Joetta Keene just made to Judge Gallagher, we are only calling, or something to the effect, only calling Officer Cooper. So in case there's any question about what the nature of the appellate complaint is, the nature of the appellate complaint is whether or not reasonable suspicion, not probable cause, reasonable suspicion existed for the stop in the parking lot. Now, as far as the factors forming this court's duty to review legal sufficiency challenges in the light most favorable to the verdict and draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the jury's verdict, I won't go through all of the facts there because these legal sufficiency challenges have a way of turning into a jury argument. But, Judge, I think that your questions to Mr. Henderson highlighted all of the primary facts. I went through them kind of factor by factor in my brief. But if you look at the case Ingerson versus State from the Court of Criminal Appeals, all of the factors that I cited and all the factors that you cited, Judge, are found in the Ingerson case and determined by the Court of Criminal Appeals to be relevant and instructive in determining legal sufficiency in circumstantial evidence cases. This is actually a much stronger case than the Ingerson case because in Ingerson, that was originally reversed by this court, not this same panel, but reversed by this court, the gun that was found there, well, actually, the gun wasn't found. It was simply proven that the defendant once owned a gun similar to the weapon that was used in the murders. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said that was a strong factor indicating guilt. Here, we had not only a gun owned by the defendant that was used to commit the murder, we have the very gun owned by the defendant and found stuffed in his waistband 2 hours after the murder. That gun was connected forensically to the murder. So I think even if this was a close question before Ingerson, it's not a close question now. I don't frankly think these particular facts would have been a close question for this court prior to Ingerson, but certainly after the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in September, and to Mr. Henderson's credit, he filed his brief in July, so he didn't have the benefit of the Ingerson opinion at that time. But I think if you go through Ingerson factor by factor, there clearly was sufficient evidence in this case, albeit circumstantial, to convince a rational trier of fact, the jury in this case, of the defendant's guilt beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, we don't. In Ingerson, we had proof of motive that's lacking in this case.
Ingerson would have disagreed with the proof of motive, and the reason that I didn't put motive, it is unclear here what motivated the defendant. Mr. Henderson pointed out in his brief that the defendant's mentally ill. Was it the mental illness? The defendant was, when he went into the Quick Trip station, was attempting to buy a beer. And because it was after midnight, the clerk refused to sell him a beer. Was he upset about that and took it out on the first person he saw when he left? Was there an incidence of road rage maybe before? Or did Mr. Lewandyke cut him off in traffic before he made the delivery? We don't know, but we do know he was there immediately after. And the question about leaving the scene quickly, it's an inference because you can see on the video and the audio that was captured that you see the Mustang, the white Mustang, drive by, and it's captured from an interior camera. And there's some glare from the window of the store, which appears to be tinted of itself. And then there's glare from the windows on the car. So you can't see it clearly, but it does have a kind of a distinctive, as people noted, the officers noted, black stripe down, a racing stripe down the side of the car. It can be seen right after the six pops are heard. There is a car, which, assuming that it left... and it was the only car in the parking lot turning left immediately, you see some headlights of a car driving off very, very fast. So I think inferentially, you can assume that was the defendant driving away. Also, you've got the fact that when the defendant, he was acting very, very strange on each of these stops. I mean, when he was stopped by the trooper Blue in Palo Pinto, he said he was on his way to California, San Diego, I think he said. And so that trooper let him go, too. But then just a few hours later, he was back in the vicinity of the Quick Trip, which, of course, is the exact opposite direction. So he wasn't traveling to San Diego. And the defense attorney at trial, the only witness that they called, was a witness who testified as to all of these prescription drugs found in the defendant's car. I guess legally prescribed. But I think the insinuation is there was something wrong with the guy. So that may have been the motive. I didn't put that in the brief because I'm not sure, and I don't think the jury was locked into that. But I think that this is a much, when you compare factor to factor, this is a much stronger case than in Ingerson versus State. Thank you, judges.
Thank you. Mr. Henderson?
I think we've heard the old metaphor that nature abhors a vacuum, and our court system, if the metaphor works, abhors Anders Breeze. We have come forward with the best good faith arguments that we can make in this case. The defense attorneys filed their motion to suppress, and we have come forward with the best argument that we have that it's legally insufficient, and we are making that argument in good faith, and we ask that you consider those arguments.
Thanks, sir.
All right. We do appreciate your arguments and your conscientious representations here today, and your case is submitted.